Levi, the son of Alphaeus, who's sitting at a tax booth, and says, "Follow me," and he got up and followed him. We see this same story in Luke and perhaps also in Matthew, where the character who gets up and follows is named Matthew. But then Jesus goes to dinner in Levi's house. And many tax collectors and sinners were also sitting with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the scribes and Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And of course, the problem was that a pious person eating with such a crowd would make himself unclean. And therefore have to, at least technically, go through the rituals of purification in order to once again take part in the things that had to do with the temple or with any other kinds of Jewish piety. We could connect this up to larger themes in Mark's Gospel. Jesus has this habit of going into unclean places. The places where, like where the Gadarene demoniac lives with his tomb mates, the most unclean of all people, howling at the sky and basically out of control in the presence of 2,000 pigs. And Jesus goes there, and instead of him becoming totally unclean, the whole place becomes clean. And Mark will build up to this theme with Jesus going into all manner of unclean territories, and instead of him becoming unclean, the places become clean. But in this instance, Jesus doesn't choose to teach anything about cleanness, but simply says, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I come to call not the righteous, but the sinners." Which, to me, to make a long story short, simply means that what Jesus has to offer can only be received as gift. You can't earn it. And these people who object to him eating where he is eating are people who want to sit at the tables they sit at because they deserve to, because they have done what it takes to be righteous enough to sit in the proper company, and not in the company that you must only receive as gift. So Jesus, if your life is fine, if everything's perfect in your life and you are perfect, Jesus has nothing for you. If you're in need, then Jesus has something for you. Otherwise, just wait. John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. People came and said to him, "Why do John's disciples and the disciples of Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast?" Jesus says, "The wedding guests can't fast while the bridegroom is with them, can they?" As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they can't fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away. They can fast then. Which, to me, to make a long story short, casts the previous meal settings into the Messianic feast category. The meals that he's having in these out-of-the-way strange places where the righteous would never sit turn out to be the festal meal of the great wedding banquet, which is one of the ways of, that constantly the gospel tradition talks about the Messianic feast. So what no one can see is that the Messianic kingdom is already at hand, because of where Jesus is eating. Well then, finally, this little cycle of meal stories ends up with a strange picnic in a grain field. where on the Sabbath day, Jesus and his disciples are picking a bit of grain, and the Pharisees, who I presume have only traveled the Sabbath day's journey in order to be able to do this, leap out of some kind of bushes and say, "Ha ha, we caught you! Picking grain on the Sabbath." And then we get a conversation about Torah and what is acceptable and what is not. Reaping any kind of grain is specifically listed in the Torah as forbidden on the Sabbath. You need to look it up. It's Exodus 34:21. But there have been other rabbis who taught what Jesus teaches about Torah in this little story. There's an ancient rabbinic saying, old already in Jesus' day, that said, "The Sabbath is delivered unto you. You are not delivered unto the Sabbath," which is the equivalent of Jesus saying, "The Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath." Or as we might say today, "The clock is your servant. You are not the clock's servant." But we don't get that very straight. At least us type A's don't. Moreover, other ancient rabbis also had cited things like the story of David as an example of how a lower level law that covered things like reaping could be broken in order to honor a higher level law, such as saving a life or allowing a starving person to have something to eat. There may be also here some engagement between Jesus and the Pharisees over the Pharisaic dream of bringing on the reign of God by keeping the perfect Sabbath. If you ever wondered why the Pharisees are so obsessed with the Sabbath, it's partly explainable by the fact that a piece of Pharisaic tradition was that if just once all Jews everywhere would keep the perfect Sabbath the way the Torah required, just once, one Sabbath, and you'd think Sabbath would be the easiest thing in the world to keep because all it asks is that you rest. Just once, people would do that. God would bring on, would restore the fortunes of Israel and bring on the new age. But people kept screwing up. And here was Jesus out there one more time. Now we got reaping going on. And it just drove them bananas. I do always have to teach my students to be a little charitable with Pharisees. People like myself grew up thinking that the word meant smart aleck jerk who hated Jesus. But this was a community of deep piety. People who had kept Judaism alive when so many others had simply capitulated to the Hellenistic Empire and given up the Jewish traditions and the Jewish the Orthodox practices of Judaism and so on. So the Pharisees were a very pious group, but they also had streaks that were a little too much like some of ours. So on to today's agenda then. Two banquets and a choice of desserts is what I've titled this, and we're in Mark 6 at this point, the next meal settings in this gospel. And we're going to start with the one that's known as the feeding of the 5,000. It's the only miracle story that's in all four gospels, because John shares this one. John has similar miracles to many of those that appear in the synoptics, but this is the only one that's precisely the same. So this is among the most familiar of all stories in the gospel tradition, including to children. I think we mostly, as kids, grew up loving John's version most, because there's that boy in John's version of the story from whom they get this stuff that they share around. So it's always sort of heroic for a child to realize that this would have happened if they hadn't stolen that kid's lunch. But let's read the story of the feeding of the multitude in Mark 6, beginning at verse 30 and going to verse 44. Let's read it out loud and get it out into the space. Is somebody willing to read the whole thing?
The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, "Come away to a deserted place all by yourselves and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. As he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy something for themselves to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves have you? Go and see." When they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and of fifties. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. And all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. Those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000 men.
All right, thank you. I think somewhat instinctively, at least if my recollections of knowing this story as a child are at all typical, the fascination of this story is in wondering exactly how the miracle, or maybe where the miracle took place that we behold here. Did this stuff multiply as Jesus handed it out? Did it multiply as the disciples handed it out? Did it multiply in the hands of the people who received it, or did it sort of swell in their stomachs as they ate, so that a couple of crumbs, you know, like sponge-like, oh, well, we've got enough? You know, I remember as a kid thinking, just exactly how did this work, and when did they notice what was happening? And then, of course, when I was older, I read all those theories about how, well, it just sort of convinced everyone else to haul out their secret stash, which is an interesting thought, but it's sort of beside the point. What I didn't realize was that even as a child, I had thoughts that I didn't know at the time were wilderness thoughts, long before I could have connected this story to the wilderness tradition, as I'll show you it's so obviously connected in a few moments. I knew it was a wilderness story without understanding wilderness stories, because I can remember thinking that I would have thought this was nice had I been there. You know, if we were all really, really hungry out there and we didn't have anything to eat and somebody fed us with bread and fish, that would have been great, but I knew very well that I would have said, I would have murmured. I would have said, "This is really great, Jesus, but Is there any butter? Or a little mayonnaise to make some tartar sauce for this fish? You gotta eat it dry? So that's murmuring in the wilderness talk right there. But in case we don't have that happen, the narrator gives us all manner of clues that we are in a place that's connected to the ancient wilderness where the people of Israel received their great gift meal. The name of the place where they are, in English, it's a deserted place. It's Eremos, Eremon Topon in Greek, a desert place, a wilderness place. It's interesting that Jesus tries to go there alone in Mark, which is fairly typical, and the only reason that he ends up with a multitude that he has to finally take care of is because they can't leave him alone, and they follow him out there. But notice, as long as we're attending to the connections of this feast to the ancient wilderness feast of Exodus 16 and beyond, first there's a water crossing. And then we get into the wilderness where the feeding needs to take place because these people are hungry and it's too late to get any food in the conventional way. Mark doesn't make exactly the same obvious connection to another piece of the ancient story, namely that it follows hard on the antics of a murderous king. But that's just in the background, and we'll have to return to that story briefly, in detail after a while. But so we've got lots of Exodus reminders here. A murderous king, a water crossing, a desert place, and then we get a multitude that's hungry. Again, Mark doesn't do what Matthew does with the numbering of this people. Mark simply cites them as 5,000 men. And I suppose we're supposed to understand that that wouldn't include everybody in the crowd in ancient times. That this was not just a bunch of men who followed Jesus out there. And Matthew takes pains to tell us that the group that Jesus fed was 5,000 men, not counting the women and children. Thus, to make sure that we don't forget Exodus 12:37, where it was 600,000, not counting the women and children who ate that first manna. But Mark leaves us to remember that for ourselves, but I think it's there. So we have reminders of plenty about the wilderness tradition of the Exodus days, of bread and meat served up miraculously, and so this is a meal that connects to the ancient time, but it's also the Messianic banquet again. It is a feast of Eucharist. It's a feast of giving thanks. Jesus does the Eucharistic action here. He takes the bread, he gives thanks, and so forth. So it's a meal that points ahead also to the end time. Commentators love to point out that Elijah did something very similar to this, though on a smaller scale, in 2 Kings 4, feeding a group with just a little tiny bit of bread. And maybe the connection of Moses and the Exodus here, along with Elijah and his feeding, is one of Mark's ways of reminding us that what Jesus did fulfills the law and the prophets, which all the Gospels attempt to do in one way or another, but usually Luke and Matthew much more blatantly. One thing that sets this meal apart from the Old Testament wilderness meals is the lack of murmuring. I mean, we readers might have murmured, or readers like me might have murmured, but you don't get complaint on the part of on the part of the people. Unless you count the impossibility thinking of the disciples. Where are we supposed to find bread out here for this people? How are we supposed to do this? And there is not frustration on the part of Jesus, as there was so many times with Moses, but rather, notice Jesus' motivation for doing something about this. He has compassion on this leaderless throng. Compassion, of course, will be the motivation for so many of the things that Jesus does. Maybe a little bit more so in Luke than in Mark, but we get this phenomenon in Mark's gospel as well. In case you've never heard this, I think this is fairly common knowledge nowadays, but to act out of compassion in the New Testament, the language is, the verb for having compassion is sponsnidzomai, which is a word that means to have your entrails stirred, to have your insides twisted and wrung. And it's an attempt to translate a Hebrew expression. The Hebrew expression for compassion is an expression that uses the word for a womb. To have compassion on someone is to have a womb for them, or to treat them as though they are or once were in your womb, which is, in effect, to treat them as though you're their mother, but perhaps more generally, to treat someone as your own flesh and blood. So that when you do something for someone out of compassion, you are doing this thing that the Torah asks, that you love your neighbor as yourself, because there is really no boundary between your neighbor and yourself. You are one flesh. You have been part of one body together when there was this womb relationship. So there is a sense in which when Jesus feeds people out of this motivation, he's not merely giving them food. He is giving them food in the obvious sense, but he's also giving them himself. He is feeding them himself. This is not living by bread alone, but this is feeding that comes from the bowels of mercy. This food comes from a deeper place than the bakery. So there's a whole new dimension to this meal, simply because that it comes from such a place. This is also a different kind of wilderness feast in some ways than the one in Exodus, because they have a lot of green grass to sit on. I don't think that means this is the meal at the oasis that Susan taught us about the other day. But here's the part that most fascinates me about this little setting notice that Mark gives us, that they're supposed to sit down in groups on the green grass. To sit down in groups, Mark uses an idiom here in the Greek. The way he says this in Greek is they were to sit down symposia symposia. This word right here, double. You know what a symposium is in the ancient classical tradition of the Greco-Roman world? Well, let me read to you from the inerrant and infallible Bauer Denker Arndt Friedrich lexicon of the New Testament. A symposium, by the way, it comes from the Greek verb sympino, which means to drink together. And literally, a symposium is a drinking party. better understood as a banquet at which sparkling conversation was highly prized, as exemplified in the Platonic dialogues and the collection of topics in Athenaeus. That's what we're doing out here in this lonely place. We're having a symposium. We're not murmuring. We're having sparkling conversations. this is maybe just an idiom, but for sitting down in groups. But I teach my students that there are no accidents and no throwaways in the New Testament. They didn't have room to waste words, much less waste phrases and sentences. You know, in John's first ending, the narrator says, you know, there are many other things that Jesus did, but this much is written. And in the second ending, he says, you know, if you tried to write down everything, the world couldn't hold all the books, so we got just this little bit here that explains it for you. And to me, that's clue enough that there was no room for throwaways. So it makes, you know, when John's gospel says there weren't just a bunch of fish they caught that one morning, but 153. that detail matters. There's a reason that it's that detail and not just a bunch. And I tell my students that they will wonder sometimes, what does that man ingest before coming here? And he insists on picking on these details. But I don't think this is an accident. I think this is a way to describe this meal as a celebration. This is not just wilderness meal. This is banquet. This is a celebration. This is maybe even that wedding feast. And finally, there are probably things I've missed, and we'll see whether you have seen some things that I've missed, but the one other thing that I'd like to comment on are the leftovers. We can't ignore here that in wilderness meals there are rules about leftovers. In other words, you can't have them except on Sabbath because they will go bad. The rations that you have collected to save for another day will go rotten on you and turn foul. But this is a different kind of banquet. Now we can collect the leftovers and save them, use them, and as we'll eventually see, distribute them. And this was the great hope of Israel for the New Age. There was a lot of language in the period prior to Jesus' day among Jews about what the New Age, what would be the signs and the features of the New Age. And one of the features of the New Age was that again we would receive the bread of the angels. We would receive everything that we need here in the wilderness of life. Only this time we could collect the leftovers. We would not just have enough. We would have abundance. We would have more than enough. Or in their language, we could have tomorrow's bread today, and not in the form of credit cards. We pray for this. We have a piece of our Christian tradition that still prays for this thing that the ancients prayed for. It doesn't appear in Mark, so this is a slight excursion. But in the prayer that Mark knew, because Jesus prays it in Gethsemane, but gets taught in Matthew and in Luke, particularly in the Matthean version, we pray, we say in English, give us today our daily bread. Mm-hmm. In case you've never heard this, the word there for the bread that we receive doesn't mean daily bread. It means tomorrow's bread. What we really pray in that prayer is, give us today the bread of tomorrow. So we're not just praying for daily provisions to get us through today. We're praying for the Messianic feast. Bring on the great feast. Which is why you don't teach this prayer in the early church to people who aren't yet baptized and don't know what this prayer means. Because you don't want to be praying for the consummation till you're ready and you know what you're doing. This isn't just begging for one more day's rations, but for the Messianic feast. So we have that as a piece of this feast. This banquet out here in the wilderness is the ancient wilderness feast, but it's also the great feast of the end time. We are having a moment of the present. In the present, we are having a moment of the future, a foretaste of the feast to come, as we like to say. Okay, that's the first meal of the two banquets and the choice of desserts. You have things I missed? Questions about this first banquet?
I was curious, in each of that retelling of that story, each of the Gospels, does that story follow the beheading of John the Baptist? Is that the order in each of those?
In Matthew. In Mark, it's the same. Yeah, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment, because that's the other banquet that we need to deal with. That banquet is inseparable from this one. But yeah, if Matthew, Mark does this, and then Matthew takes it and develops it just slightly further. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Any significance to that? In the groups of hundreds and fifties, and where does that come from?
I don't know. I looked all over the place. Yeah, I looked all over the place for the significance of those numbers, and there were some odd suggestions that didn't make much sense to me, so I didn't write them down. Has anybody ever worked on that or thought about that?
Might it have something to do with the seed, the parable of the seed, where things grow in certain multiples?
Oh. Well, I know. Yeah, that's worth thinking about. Would the growth of the food happen in the way that the exponential growth of the seed happens? That's worth thinking about, yeah.
There's probably some significance to the fact that there are 12 baskets left over.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yes. And, of course, what we'll do, what day is today?
Wednesday.
Friday. We're going to realize that there's another story just like this, with a different number of loaves and a different number of baskets and a different kind of basket, because that's a different meal about a different thing. So it is very important that this has 12 baskets and that they are a specific kind of basket. These are the baskets of the bread that is the bread of tomorrow for the whole house of Israel. Or the 12 tribes.
I've always been curious that they were out there and somebody had baskets.
Yeah.
They must have brought in.
Yeah, there's all manner of incidentals in these stories that it's interesting to wonder, well, where did the basket? Was some entrepreneur out there thinking? We're following Jesus because we want to see where he's going, but I'll bring baskets just in case.
Pass around the collection plate.
Another interesting thing is that if symposia implies sparkling discussion and dialogue, those numbers are too large. You have to have tables like we have the round tables in the dining hall.
Yeah. I don't know, look at this. We got a fairly sparkling conversation. We haven't tried to eat in here yet, but yeah. No, you're right. Hundreds and fifties would be not exactly your ideal discussion group.
On the hundreds and fifties, do you know offhand, in the army units, they sit, have census and stuff for the compost? What size are those trees?
What did she say?
She asked whether this could be a corresponding set of numbers to military deployment of soldiers. Well, not so much. I mean, I don't know a great deal about Roman military numbers, and I know virtually nothing about what. I mean, the Jews weren't allowed to have a military, and their tradition would have had some things that go back to, you know, like Gideon and his 300, and of course, it is true that in 1 Samuel 8, now that I think about it, when Samuel gets this message from God about why kings are such a bad idea, one of the things that God tells Samuel to tell the people is that not only will you have the military draft and the IRS and the civil service and the military industrial complex, but there are details to this that he will have to choose people to be captains of 50s. So it's possible that this is a military category that goes back deep into the ancient tradition. Romans, you know, a cohort of the Roman soldiers was 600 people, and sometimes they split up into 200. It's three groups of 200, so I don't know.
Alan Story talked about this story last summer, and he said that he thought breaking up into smaller groups was a way to kind of facilitate community and sharing.
Well, that's what the symposia idea would do. It would be to get into groups where you could have sparkling discussion. That's what the previous comment was about. That's a little bit big for a community.
The idea it would be harder to hoard if people could.
Yeah. I'd be more inclined to think that this just given where we're finding this story, I would think that if it has anything at all to do with military, it would be to be not anti-military, but different from military. So if it's using military numbers, it's using them for a purpose, this is a different kind of army. I'm more inclined to think that it has something to do with symposia.
I was wondering about this happening, how close it was to the death of Jesus. Because I can kind of see that the authorities might think that he really is a rebellion. This must have happened on the weekday because people couldn't walk that far on a Sabbath, could they? Mm-hmm. So where all these people, they would normally have been out in the vineyards and the fields and whatever.
Yeah. Well, Mark's not super interested in those particular kinds of questions. The crowds sort of do what they want. And the crowds are actually a character in Mark's gospel. You can follow them and their behavior, and they have their own story. But if all we had was Mark's gospel, the entire gospel could have happened within a few weeks. I love to ask my students this. How old was Jesus when he died, and how long of a public ministry did he have? And they all say, well, he died when he was 33, and he had a three-year ministry. And we only know that, we only assume that, because Luke says he was 30 years old when he started his public ministry, and because John has Jesus attending three Passovers. If all you had is Mark, this whole thing could have happened very quickly. From baptism to death could have been months.
Happens immediately.
The whole thing happened really fast.
I just wanted to make a comment. I keep thinking of Psalm 23, the Good Shepherd, and lying down in green pastures, the green grass, and then also preparing the table before you, feeding you.
Yes, and hang on to that, because there is a connection. Obviously, yeah, that's a detail I forgot to comment on, that Jesus has compassion on them because they are like sheep without a shepherd, which is political talk in ancient times. That's king language. to have a shepherd, especially among the Jewish people. You know, David, the shepherd boy, forever made shepherd talk, king talk. And so Jesus, you know, this is the Messianic banquet also in the sense that this is the king coming to you to give you, to feed you. But there's a feature, even in that wonderful poem, Psalm 23, that we're going to come up against. I'm going to arbitrarily shift to this other story, and so that we make sure we get both of these banquets in on one day. The other banquet, of course, is the one that happens just prior to the feeding of the 5,000. And so I'm going to ask somebody to read aloud also Mark 6, verses 14 to 29. Is there somebody willing to read that out into the space?
King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. Some said John the Baptizer had been raised from the dead. That is why these powers are at work in him. But others said, it is Elijah. And others said, it is a prophet like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I have beheaded, has been raised. For Herod had sent and seized John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because he had married her. For John said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to kill him. But she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man and kept him safe. When he heard him, he was much perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. For an opportunity came, when Herod on his birthday gave a banquet for his courtiers and officers and the leading men of Galilee. For when Herodias' daughter came in to dance, she pleased Herod and his guests. And the king said to the girl, ask me for whatever you wish and I will grant it. And he vowed to her, what you ask me, I will give you even half of my kingdom. And she went out and said to her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptizer. And she came in immediately with haste to the king and asked, saying, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptizer on a platter. And the king was exceedingly sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he did not want to break his word to her. And immediately the king sent a soldier of the guard and gave orders to bring his head. He went and beheaded him in the prison and brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard of it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb.
Okay. So that's the banquet that precedes the banquet that we just read. So Mark 6 has two banquets, two feasts, and two different desserts. Matthew connects this story even more obviously to the feeding of the 5,000 by doing this, that at the end of the scene of at Herod's palace, Matthew says that the disciples came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. And when Jesus heard this, he withdrew in a boat to a deserted place by himself. And when the crowds heard it, they followed him. So Matthew connects these two stories by saying this is the very reason Jesus went off to this lonely place, because he had heard this about John the Baptist. And so what happens is a response. What happens in the second story is very clearly a response to what happens in the first story. This whole Herod Herodias thing is wonderful gossip. This is Herod Antipas, a son of Herod the Great, who had inherited from his father a portion of the kingdom the Jewish homeland. Herod Antipas ruled up in the north from 4 BC all the way to, beyond the life of Jesus into the 30s, 39, I think, was when he was finally ousted. But Herod Antipas had married a Samaritan. And by the way, the whole Herod outfit was really from, they were called Idumeans, which is Greek for Edomites. You know what we think of Edomites. And read Psalm 137 sometime if you want to know what we really think of Edomites. They were cheerleaders for the Babylonians. They said, knock it down, way down. So when the Romans got in cahoots with this Herodian crowd to be the puppet kings, this was despicable people from the get-go for most Jews, and especially for pious Jews. And then Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great, had married a Samaritan. And then he divorced her, which was its own scandal. And he was harassed by his former father-in-law for the rest of his life over this. And he took to wife this Herodias woman, who was in fact his niece, who was married to his half-brother. So this is Jerry Springer stuff. So he had to divorce his own wife to take this other wife, who he shouldn't have had in the first place, even if she had been free. She was married to a different of his uncles, Herod's half-brother, Philip. And John the Baptist had railed against all the impropriety of this, as had all kinds of other people. John the Baptist was not alone. So Herodias, not Herod, but the offended new wife had insisted that Herod be imprisoned, and so he was. John had been in prison, and so he was in Herod's prison for this event. I think that there's a very clear reason why we have to have this banquet immediately preceding the other one. And I believe, I think this is more than just my homiletical instincts or my personal theology. I think this is the two great banquets juxtaposed next to each other. And if we had our druthers, we would really much prefer to be at the first and not the second. Because there is no more delightful meal, no more wonderful symposia, if you will, where we have truly sparkling conversation than at those meals where we have the head of our critic on a platter. The meal that celebrates our having been proved right and our having been proved victorious and our having silenced finally those who have criticized us, harassed us, made our lives difficult, or whatever. I have my little bird calls that I do all over the place about the human need to be right and to be proved right. I like to say that Maslow's hierarchy of needs is slightly flawed. That human beings love more than anything else and want and need more than anything else to be right about everything and to be proved right about everything, even more than security and warmth and food and water, even more than sex. We want to be right and to be proved right. And if you don't believe me, try this little experiment. Either join a church or get married. Because those two institutions are the most effective laboratories known to humankind, in which people's need to be right gets tested. And to have the moment where you are proven right, and your enemy is silenced, your critic is finally shut down, and can harass you no more, is the ultimate meal that we seek. And some of our most sacred traditions are about that, including Psalm 23, where we will not only have this feast, we will have it in the presence of our enemies, who aren't educated, but we are. Or, since we're so connected to the Exodus in this moment, probably, as Susan was intimating the other day, Miriam's song is the older one. And the one that gets put on the lips of Moses, which starts with the same words, which is attributed to Moses, the song of the crossing of the sea. Notice what it celebrates. It doesn't just celebrate that we made it across, but it celebrates the fact that the Egyptians didn't. And their sons and their horses are floating and bloating in the water. Pharaoh's horses got drowned. Oh, that's what we love to sing. Not just that we made it, but that they died. Those bleeping bleeps who walked around with the clipboards all those years and made us count the bricks, and then made us make them without straw. We hate those. And they're dead. They're dead. And we made it. The hell with them. Now I'm going to tell you one that we have to come back to at the end of the week. The great banquet of Isaiah 25 that we celebrate at least every third Easter as our first lesson. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, a rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wines strained clear. He will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces and the disgrace of his people. He will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It will be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him so that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation, for the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain. That's where we stop. But if we kept reading, this is what we find. But the Moabites shall be trodden down in their place, like straw trodden in a dung pit. Though they spread out their hands in the midst of it, as swimmers spread out their hands to swim, their pride will be laid low despite the struggle of their hands. So while we celebrate on the mountain, drinking fine wine and eating fat things, the Moabites down below are swimming in our urine. And there's a lot of it given all that wine. They're swimming in our urine and eating our dung. That's what the great banquet of Isaiah 25 really looks like. That's the whole picture. Because that's the banquet, that's the conventional victor's banquet that every people has thirsted after for as long as people have fought the way they do and loved to be right and to be vindicated. And that's the classic picture even in the scriptures, even in our favorite texts, like Psalm 23. But Jesus' banquet is different. Jesus' banquet has no outsiders. Everybody out there in that crowd part of it. There were no vanquished. There were no enemies. It's the messianic banquet in which the whole crowd is welcome. And that's the difference between these two banquets. And the dessert is not the head of our enemy on a platter, but the dessert is those leftovers that we get to distribute. And tomorrow we'll start seeing where we're going to distribute them. And it ain't the top of the mountain. Okay, that's where we'll stop. And we'll eat some more tomorrow. Want to sing? We don't have to, I just thought if you had something cooked up.
Yeah. Sure.
Let's sing on our way out, shall we? How about Rest of the Journey on page 6. Same page, next song. The tune sounds like this. Give us bread for the journey. Give us bread. Give us bread for the journey. Thank you.